You're listening to the Business of Pharmacy podcast with me, your host, Mike Kelzer. Alex, for those that haven't come across you online, tell our listeners who you are and what we're talking about today.
My name is Alex Oshmiansky. I'm the Chief Executive Officer and founder of the Mark Cuban Cost Plus Drug Company. I am a physician by training, a diagnostic radiologist. Still practice every Saturday night. I still do a diagnostic radiology shift. The Mark Cuban Cost Plus Drug Company is dedicated to producing low-cost versions of ultra-high-cost generic drugs. And we launched about a month ago with our first product. And would love to chat about it.
Why radiology? What interested you in that years ago?
So I actually also have a PhD in mathematics.
And a law degree.
No. I went to law school for a year just out of curiosity.
You went there. Then you got smart and said, no, thank you.
I loved it. Those guys were fun. Surprisingly fun. You wouldn't think of it, honestly, I had started a company before and had so much in legal fees. I was just like, you know what? This is me just being grumpy, like George Costanza ask. I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to learn it myself.
So then you ended up in a PhD in mathematics and then a MD and studying radiology.
Yeah, that's right. So I did started a MD PhD program.
Oh, gotcha.
So it was a joint program from the start.
Gotcha.
And just happened to do the PhD part of it in a field called mathematical biology, where you use mathematics to describe biological systems. I had always had an interest in very quantitative things. Nice way to combine medicine and, you know, physics, mathematics, in a way that helps people very directly. So
say you're doing that every Saturday night. What got in the way of that during your weekdays? When did you stop doing your regular practice of medicine, and what got in the way of that?
So when I was still going through my radiology training, I had been working with a group of patients with a condition called primary pulmonary artery hypertension. These patients needed, I was working with a pulmonologist on a research study, and he had patients who needed a medication called Bosentan, which I'm sure many of your listeners are probably familiar with.
I'm not, but I'm sure they are.
Oh, sure.
My listeners know I'm not too smart on that drug stuff.
Okay. Basically, it treats a condition called primary pulmonary artery hypertension. So hypertension specifically of the big blood vessel that comes out of the heart and goes to the lungs. It's a off-patent medication, went off patent, 20, 30 years ago, something like that. But it's still tremendously expensive. At the time it was, $20,000 list price for a month's supply. Patients were meant to apply to patient assistance programs, to these nonprofits that cover their copays for these drugs when they couldn't otherwise afford it. But several patients needed it urgently, kind of fell through the cracks. Nobody knew there was a problem, and they died. Mm. Obviously a horrible, horrible situation, and kind of stuck with me that I was just angry that this situation would exist. And, if I'm being perfectly honest, Martin Shkreli happened. Do you remember him?
The farmer bro. Yeah,
and it was just kind of the straw that broke the camel's back. And I was like, you know what? Someone's going to make a pharmaceutical company that just makes reasonably priced versions of these medications. Founded the company then. That was about 5 years ago or so.
And had you already graduated from med school then or not?
Oh, yeah. So I graduated med school a while ago. I'm old, but still like that.
You'd been practicing medicine daily when you decided that this was a problem in your memory that had been coming back of why this was so expensive, and then Martin helped push it along a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so, I graduated med school back in 2009 and finished my residency and fellowship training. So, the other training you need to complete before you're allowed to practice independently as a doctor around 2015. And basically start this company actually as a nonprofit almost immediately after I completed my medical training. And sort of worked, began practicing full-time as a as a diagnostic radiologist at that point, while trying to raise the financing necessary to get the company off the ground. You know, unfortunately, a pharmaceutical company is a rather capital intensive business. My plan had been to sort of work, you know, overtime as a radiologist and put money away in the background, like save it up and then all donate it as a bolus. But, you know, it was going to take a long, long time to do that. So
was your goal actually with this company, was it to try to find ways to work with the industry? Or did you actually start from the beginning saying, I want to make medicine that is cheaper?
Yeah, so the initial intent was just like, I'm going to make medicine. You know, it's kind of wound in other directions as, you know, better strategies sort of unfolded. At the time, I think it's fair to say I was relatively naive at the start of this journey. But yeah, initially, you know, the idea was just do it from scratch, get our own ANDAs, our own ANDAs, abbreviated new drug approvals, perhaps contract manufacture out the manufacturing of the actual drugs themselves. So that was the initial intent. But, you know, it wound up being the case that with several of these drugs, you know, the manufacturers actually are not the issue. It's the actual intermediaries in the supply chain between the pharmacist and the patient and the pharmaceutical manufacturer that wind up, dramatically increasing the cost of these drugs.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, our first product, actually, we're doing albendazole. We did not manufacture ourselves. It's actually a private label product. So there's actually another manufacturer, we just put our own label on it. We put our own NDC code on it, which lets us set the WAC price, wholesale acquisition cost, as well as the AWP price. And we can publish that publicly, you know, whichever way we like. But, you know, the actual manufacturing, the actual ANDA is held by another company.
For our listeners, that drug is one that would be a great first one to start because it's treating a problem for those typically financially disadvantaged, right?
Very strangely, in the 21st century, an old 19th century condition has reemerged, in America, primarily the American South, where it's a bit warmer, which is hookworm, which is a parasitic infection you get basically from stepping on sewage. It burrows its way through your feet.
An open sore or just through your skin?
No, just through your skin.
No kidding.
Wow. Straight through. Yeah.
Jeez. And,
it's not like generally not an emergently life-threatening condition, but if it sort of is left to fester for years, it can cause, you know, growth defects, neurologic problems, anemia, you know, number of very difficult problems. And it can actually be treated with only two tablets of albendazole. It doesn't require, generally doesn't really require more than that. But when the list price of albendazole is $250 a tablet or $500, suddenly it becomes cost prohibitive particularly for the indigent population, which is disproportionately affected by this condition. You know, they're not able to afford $500
for
treatment, and health systems aren't able to afford mass treatment protocols for that price. Albendazole is a very old medicine. It's on the WHO list of essential medicines. And in most of the world, you can get it for 50 cents a tablet. But due to a variety of market conditions, you're just able to keep that price super high in the United States, and people have kept it that way. So we essentially did is we talked directly to one of the manufacturers of albendazole. I'm under a non-disclosure agreement, so, you know, can't say exactly what we got it for, but let's just say it costs us on average about $13 a tablet, all the way from purchasing it, packaging it, labeling it, serializing it, and distributing it, per tablet to get us out there. We put a flat 15.15% margin, which gives us our $15 price point to pharmacies. What I've been told by the pharmacists that I've spoken to so far is that if you try to get the same product from McKesson, it costs closer to $125 a tablet. That delta, presumably McKesson has significantly more purchasing power than I do. So that delta is, you know, they're probably buying it for even less. And that delta is just being captured by McKesson or any the other big wholesalers. And then you have the pharmaceutical benefit manager at the end of the day getting their cut of the rebate. So you wind up with the intermediaries getting, you know, almost 10x the purchase price just in fees along the way before the drug is even sold to the patient or the insurance payer. So essentially what we do is we try to disintermediate this chain through price transparency and just say, hey, this is actually what it costs us to acquire, distribute this drug. You know, anything above that, you know, use your kind of common sense in terms of, you know, whether that's a fair price or not.
I love your LinkedIn about you. It says making affordable medicines. That's perfect. I wish we all could know so succinctly what our mission is. So obviously you want the people to see that cheaper, but who do you, when you say like people can then see what's happening, who are those people that you would like to see when you say, yeah, we'd like to show all this kind of fluff in the prices? Is there anybody that you kind of want to be seeing this?
Obviously one, the patients themselves.
Sure.
So, you know, specifically for albendazole, we'll be distributing for free, you know, a large portion of that initial order to, you know, start the mass treatment protocols with our, you know, colleagues at the Baylor School of Medicine. They'll do mass treatment throughout the South to begin re-eradicating hookworm. You know, it should have been gone a long time ago, came back. Now we can wipe it out again because we can get the drug at a reasonable price. So starting there.
People maybe who couldn't imagine that before are certainly imagining it now by seeing what's happening with the COVID vaccines, for example.
Exactly. But, you know, moreover, you know, certainly we'd hope that, you know, we can educate policymakers, you know, people in positions of authority who are trying to determine what the best policy is to really reduce costs for Americans about, you know, where the actual problematic aspects of the pharmaceutical supply chain are. I'm sure many of your listeners have been squeezed tremendously by DIR fees, other shenanigans. And these are such, you know, forgive me, you know, relatively obscure issues to the layman. You know, I mean, part of our marketing is, you know, we are a pharmaceutical manufacturer, and we are setting up our own sterile fill finish facility.
In Texas, right?
Yep. Which we're hoped to have online and sort of commissioned and validated in 2022. That'll be focused on, you know, rare disease, shortage drugs, drugs where it is actually challenging to you know, actually obtain the drug at all.
I see. So those aren't the ones that are easily available. It's just not the Delta. It's actually maybe hard to get a hold of them and more than just albendazole would have been.
Exactly. So there are specific drugs that are actually challenging to acquire at a full price. Disproportionately, units tend to be sterile injectables. So that's the sterile fill finish facility. But moreover, you know, we describe ourselves, even sort of the private label part of our business, as being a pharmaceutical manufacturer because, you know, patients don't understand what a pharmaceutical benefit manager is. You know, it's startling. You know, even before they merged with other healthcare conglomerates, the PBMs were all Fortune 20, Fortune 25 companies, the largest companies, some of the largest companies in America by revenue. And yet at the same time, the pharmaceutical benefit managers, it's not just that people haven't heard of the specific companies, they've never heard of the industry as a whole. So there's a big sort of educational challenge to the lay public.
Let me see if I've got this right. Did you say that you call it just a manufacturer because people don't understand pharmacy benefit manager and things?
Yeah. So we are setting up a sterile fill finish facility in Dallas, Texas. And that facility is going to be focused on shortage drugs, on rare disease orphan drugs, where, you know, it can be difficult or cost prohibitive to get a hold of the drugs, you know, period. So we will be a manufacturer.
But would you call yourself anything but a manufacturer? Are you also a PBM in a sense and stuff like that? Or did I hear that wrong?
You know, more broadly, we're also exploring, you know, other supply chain mechanisms to get our products out there. So are we kind of like de facto a wholesaler in a sense? You know, in a sense, you know, essentially we're, you know, at sort of two parts of the business in my mind. One, the actual core manufacturing, and two, sort of a supply chain innovation business aim to find ways to get products to patients at transparent pricing and sort of get past the sort of gatekeepers between patients, pharmacists, and the actual drugs themselves.
And so when you're talking to people, the easiest way, and part of this whole company is on communication also, the easiest way to say is, we're a manufacturer of medicines. And if you're interested enough to talk more about it, we can go into a little bit more what that means. But let's just say we're a manufacturer right now.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Because people understand intuitively what a pharmaceutical manufacturer is. You know, what is the role of a wholesaler? People know what a wholesaler is, but they don't understand why it might be, you know, problematic in the pharmaceutical industry or Cardinal, McKesson, and AmerisourceBergen, what their role is, the role of the big PBMs are. This is not something that's in the lay person's day-to-day life. For messaging, that helps. But I think, you know, part of the next step of the company is sort of educating, you know, not just patients, not just policymakers, but also, you know, the lay public as to where the actual problematic aspects of the pharmaceutical supply chain are, in terms of where the value is not actually being added, but it's being extracted, and revealing that just by, you know, just showing our work, you know, showing where the costs come in, what it costs us to do each individual step of the distribution process, and just laying it all out on the line. So this is what it costs, and this is what it should cost you to acquire the drugs at the end of the day.
Yeah, I like the way how you describe that. I've heard it put that way before, and maybe someone would argue with it, but yeah, it's not that we're not getting a lot of value from someone. It's actually that they're not adding any value and they're extracting it. I would certainly throw PBMs in the mix there, and somebody might not if they're, well, let's put opaque PBMs, because there are some good ones out there, and I've talked to some good ones, but they're just stripping that out of there. So Alex, where did you pick up your knowledge then? And maybe you can't even pinpoint it because you've been doing it for, you know, 6 or 7 years, whatever. Where did you pick up your knowledge of DIRs and all that stuff? Did that just soak in over time, or did you have a source for that? Or
no, that's a good question. I think it's probably more the former, just sort of, you know, rolling it in over time, you know, doing research. You know, it's tricky because there's no like centralized source of this information you can go through. There's no like textbook of why drugs are so expensive. Just sort of,
if there was, it would be bombed by somebody, you know.
Yeah. would not be around long.
No, you wouldn't want to have your residence there or something.
Exactly. So, you know, it's more just like conversations like these, you know, with countless dozens, hundreds of individuals, the course of the better part of the last decade, in terms of trying to figure out, you know, what are the problems and how do we get past them? And, you know, it's obviously extremely challenging. Lots of people have taken this on, but, you know, you got to take up the good fight, you know, got to give it our own shot.
Most people might look just to money to say, well, that's where your speed bump is in getting this going. But maybe more intricate, or maybe dividing that down, where were the biggest roadblocks in you moving forward? I'm assuming there's always roadblocks, you know, in a good story.
So yeah, no, I think that's largely it. Is capital is a huge part of the problem.
Capital.
Yeah, trying to get the capital necessary to get things off the ground. In the first like 3 years or so, the company as a nonprofit did not have any luck raising any kind of capital. Hmm. $0 raised outside of what I invested myself. But eventually ran into a group of venture capitalists in Silicon Valley that periodically invested in nonprofits, an organization called Y Combinator, which is a quote unquote startup accelerator. And I went to Silicon Valley to interview with them.
How do they accelerate? Just financially, or do they throw some other stuff behind it?
So Y Combinator has been the initial investor in a wide variety of companies you've probably heard of. What have they done? Dropbox, Airbnb. They're well-known sort of investors. And, you know, they have a residential program. They invest a small amount of capital. They sort of mentor you. And then at the end, they introduce you to a whole bunch of investors. And they were great. Basically their feedback was, you know, when I talked to them about the nonprofit was, we like what you're doing, but you will not be able to raise enough money to get this off the ground as a nonprofit. If you reincorporate as a for-profit public benefit corporation or a for-profit company that still has a public social mission, we'll invest in you like we would in any other company.
It sounds like the second one to me was not anything official. It was just like a corporation that says we're going to do good. But was the first one you mentioned, is that actually a designation?
Oh, sure. So it's a relatively new thing. And, you know, it still remains to be seen how, you know, how much of an impact it has because it's relatively new. But
sure.
The way we're actually incorporated, we're incorporated in the state of Delaware. We are, you know, and after our name, we, instead of the initials INC Incorporated, we actually have PBC, Public Benefit Corporation.
I've never heard of that before. That's cool.
So the idea of it is, you know, in principle, as a, you know, just an average C Corp, like your actual, it's actually in law that your obligation is to maximize profit for shareholders. You can be penalized for not doing that. A public benefit corporation has in its charter, you actually, when you file your registration with the state, you have a social mission you actually put on file with the state. And then after the fact, you know, basically you're judged not only on how profitable you are for your shareholders, but on how well you accomplished your social mission.
Interesting.
Yeah. Now, it's my understanding that's never actually been litigated. Like no one's actually ever been sued for not being profitable enough. But in principle, you are formally judged as a company based on how well you accomplished your social mission.
In the PBC.
In the PBC, correct.
A regular corporation, they might have outreaches and stuff, but it probably always has to be explained in a way that says, well, yeah, we're doing this outreach, but ultimately it's going to help us increase our profits. You know, it's goodwill or it's marketing or something, but they have to keep that stock going up.
Yeah. And forgive me if I'm messing up some nuance of like corporate governance legalities, but my understanding of it is that, you know, you have this concept of fiduciary duty to your shareholders, and your actual obligation as a corporate entity is to maximize profits. And that's actually a legal standard that you can be held to.
That's what a farmer bro, that's what he would say he was doing, just increasing profits. I don't know. So maybe something's broken. Arguably, everybody would say that he's broken, but maybe the system is broken somehow.
You know, you can have a pretty compelling argument there that the externalities of having that kind of system in place greatly outweigh the like benefits of the individual profit motive at some level. Like if people are dying because they can't get access to their medicine, and people are not only, you know, in principle compelled to like maximize shareholder profits, like isn't that a pathologic system that requires some kind of intervention? Yeah.
My son and I always talk a lot where we always say that if you're going to make a rule, the rules can't really depend on just the goodness of people. One example was we bought stuff and we wanted to return it to this company. It was like a toilet seat or something like that. And the company we bought it from didn't want to return it. And we were like, yeah, but your rules say you'll take anything back. And the point I'm trying to make there, and a real simple point, is it's hard to set a rule up like that to talk about shareholders and then have somebody extend the rule to the nth and then say you're doing it wrong. It's like, well, maybe the rules have to be changed because he was playing in the rules. I don't know.
Forgive me. I'm going to wax philosophically for a bit.
Please do.
But you know, like, yeah, my PhD is in math, and in particular, I studied some systems called cellular automata, the most famous of which is Conway's Game of Life. And essentially, the way it works is you have rules on a grid. And depending on what your rules are, you get these really elaborate patterns that form, and slight tweaks to the initial rules of the game, like have amazing consequences in terms of like the patterns that form. Unfortunately, I can't really do them justice, in an audio format. But if anyone Googles the Game of Life, and cellular automata, you'll see these patterns that form. And, you know, my view of sort of the market is similar. A centralized communist market never functions because it doesn't function because there's just not enough processing power to really, adapt to like how much ice does one want. Like it's much more efficient to have multiple parallel processors essentially attacking this problem. Hundreds of thousands, millions of little companies all working to solve these problems simultaneously. But at the same time, somebody has to set the rules of the game
set the rules of the game of life, if you will, and the patterns that come out. I'm guessing will drastically vary based on what the rules are set at. And in this case, the government and, you know, our stakeholders are the ones that set the rules. So if you set the rules that, you know, profit at all costs, well, you're going to get a certain set of outcomes if you do that.
You really can't set a rule and then depend on the goodwill of people. If you have to do that, well, put it in the rules somehow. As long as you're making rules, just try to make a better rule, I guess.
Yeah, and of course it's challenging because, you know, you have unintended consequences from every rule you make. But at the same time, yeah, certainly this, you know, I think we've discovered in, you know, 21st American economic history that sort of this sociopathic view of private enterprise where, you know, everyone's in it for themselves and there's no other consideration has too many negative outcomes to really be sustainable in the long term. Maybe we have to revert to something closer to, you know, the Theodore Roosevelt type model of, you know, some sort of form of constrained or capitalism or capitalism would lose on it to really prevent these excesses that really hurt people from really taking shape.
I don't know. It's hard to put a rule on everything. You want a rule on everything, but there's always going to be someone that's trying, I suppose.
Yeah, no, and it's, you know, the devil's in the details, of course.
Yeah, that's what it is.
Yeah.
Alex, you graduated your first college degree when you were 18.
Yep, that's right.
Mm-hmm. How? Why? Is that because you were just moving faster in the classes and so on, and this was a challenge to keep moving up then?
Yeah, no, I guess, it's hard to say. I was like 13 when I started, so, you know.
Wow.
But no, I was just good at math, so they just let me keep doing stuff.
Were you like homeschooled in high school, or did you go through regular high school?
No. So I did kind of college and high school in parallel.
Gotcha. Yep.
Yeah, so actually, I was very fortunate. The school district I was at, if they didn't have a class available that was like a natural extension of taking, you know, like calculus 3 after calculus 2 or whatever, like you could take it at like the local community college, or local branch of the university college.
Were you in regular grades up until 8th grade?
Yeah.
And then you did kind of college and high school together.
So, yeah, no, I'd be, you know, reading my differential equations textbooks stuff and, you know, in the library between, you know, normal classes.
We haven't talked the medicine much, and I know you have a heart for that, but did you ever have thoughts of going more solidly math?
Oh, yeah. No, I was basically being, you know, my trajectory was to being kind of like a string theorist when I was a kid. So, you know, theoretical physics, high energy particle physics. Essentially one day I just remember reading a story on the cover of, I think it was Nature. It was either Nature or Science, one of the two big, you know, scientific journals. And it was on this big, this discovery that may have helped, I forget now, it's, you know, 20 years ago. But like, you know, that the universe is actually a 20-dimensional soccer ball. It's geometry. And I was like, you know, I want to have more action. You know, with all the wisdom of like a 17-year-old, you know, I was like, you know what, I want to have actual war in people's lives. You know,
interesting.
Yeah, so it's like, how do I do that and be a scientist? I'm going to go into medicine.
Probably a lot of pharmacists are in your category, you know, where they've got the math smarts and that, but they don't maybe want to focus just on the math things and that.
Yeah, exactly. You know, at some point, you know, you want to use your scientific proclivities to have a direct impact and directly help people. And yeah, certainly the allied health professions more broadly, medicine, pharmacy, you know, dentistry, physician assistants, all of the above are, you know, excellent ways to go about doing that. And I've always been privileged to be able to act as a medical provider in any capacity.
Do you still keep your feet wet in math? Do you still like read math stuff for kicks or?
Not really, if I'm being honest. You know, there's just too much to do. I do a little bit. I constructed an artificial intelligence that, you know, is meant to basically survey the string theory landscape. That's, you know, no practical application to this whatsoever. But, you know, there's this concept of basically in string theory, you can have like some absurd number of different potential string theories, more than, you know, particles in universe, essentially. Like,
yeah.
But most of those don't actually result in a string theory that has a viable universe that has
possible. Sure. Yeah.
Exists.
Right.
And that's called the swamp land. So the landscape is the landscape of viable universes in string theory. And the swamp land is, non-viable universes. So I coded a artificial intelligence that's cruising along the universe of string theories and trying to categorize any patterns between the swamp land and the not swamp land in the background of my laptop. But this is not super. Despite the, I like it just because it sounds fancy and it's an artificial intelligence exploring parallel universes. Reality. So,
bringing it back into the company, but I want to ask, do you have any interesting hobbies?
No, I did get into filmmaking for a while. And actually shot the first feature-length film in virtual reality.
Really?
Yeah. Premiered it at South by Southwest a few years ago.
No kidding.
And there was some interesting processing, stuff with sweeping together the film. Other than that,
that's really cool.
My wife always mentions my love of my projects to me. I tend not to have hobbies because I turn them into my career. The company was very much a passion project, and now it's 20 hours a day.
All right, so back on the company then, Alex, so you're finding out back then that you were not able to make it as a nonprofit, and then you start saying, well, I've got to look for some people that can move this along. So you went to the Y Combinator.
That's right.
And then what do you find out there that says you have to make a next move?
Oh, sure. So, they introduced me to, something like they have you pitch and, in front of a crowd. And it's something like 2,000-3,000 investors.
Wow.
That listen to the pitch. And, I was very fortunate. I was able to get a really good group of investors out of that. People who I think share the mission and ideals of the company. We're willing to support it in that way. Just kind of on a limb, I had been told that Mark Cuban read his emails, if you email him, and he does. It's just not one of his
emails. No kidding.
You email mcuban@gmail.com. He'll read your email.
That's something. Wow.
So I emailed him, and he was super enthusiastic about the idea, and has really transformed everything that we're doing. I don't want to speak for him too much, but, Mark certainly has been looking at the pharmaceutical space for some time, has really become very deeply knowledgeable about it. I always kind of saw him as, a tech guy, obviously in entertainment, sports, big figure. But I didn't realize he spent a lot of he knows about PBMs, he knows about the price fixing games.
No kidding.
And he was looking for ways to disrupt it for some time. And it just kind of clicked. And he's, overwhelmingly become the dominant investor in the organization. That's the name. I'm incredibly fortunate to have, fallen in with Mr. Cuban, because, at the end of the day, when you're actively advertising that you are not maximizing profits, that's not a great way to raise capital. I'm not going to make you some money if you do otherwise. That's not a great pitch.
Wait a minute. Back on this Y Combinator, I thought you mentioned that they take so many nonprofits or under their wings, sort of. Is that to mean that they give nonprofits a chance for the floor, seeing how they're going to be a profitable company? Or do they take the nonprofit as a loss because they feel they should do that for society? Or do they give you a chance because they think you're going to be highly profitable?
My interaction with Silicon Valley in general is that a lot of the investors are genuinely well-meaning people whose hearts are in the right place. There's definitely people who are just in it for the money and, trying to do whatever. A lot of the especially the engineers were sort of early employees at the big tech companies. They definitely have a streak of idealism in them. I think they were a certain number of, shouldn't say companies, nonprofits, we're not going to have, profitability be the most important thing with them. We're going to see if we accelerate their mission. Can we maximize social benefit by, having a couple, donating to these nonprofits and then putting them in front of the stage of 2,000 to 3,000 quote unquote investors to look for other, sources of donations for those nonprofits.
They might be getting you in front and everybody is watching you. It still might be a nonprofit-ish or the other one we mentioned, but they may not be burning holes in their own pockets doing that. Eventually, a nonprofit, the goal might be to have it self-sustainable. And so they're not seeing a company that is just going to drain money, but they know that maybe a nonprofit needs a little break at the beginning in order to then become a self-sufficient nonprofit.
Exactly, exactly. Like the people, they go in wide, eyes wide open that they're not going to make a return because, you know, they're donating, they're not investing. Could they put, for interesting nonprofits that could greatly accelerate their social mission with a little bit of capital, if they put them in front of 2,000-3,000 people and they get enough donations, could that be the, sort of activation energy necessary to get the reaction going of that nonprofit moving forward? And I obviously don't want to speak for the Y Combinator folks, but I think that that's kind of what their intent was by letting a couple nonprofits into their batches.
Get that spark going and maybe leads to something else and so on. And at minimum, leads to more recognition and maybe more donations to help get it going until whatever happens, at least till the goodness comes out.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I think it's a really interesting model. I think it has, a couple interesting success stories with that, certainly I'm glad they were willing to evaluate our application because it certainly dramatically accelerated what we were doing.
How much time do you think, let's say a major investor, either it being Mark Cuban or someone else in a position, let's say with your company or similar to this, how much time do you think is spent with maybe their legal team or the investor themselves or whatever in laying all this out? I mean, was this pages and hours and hours and pages of stuff to get Mark's name on it, or was it not as intricate, or how much is involved in that?
So Mark is really different from most of the other investors I've worked with. Like, I've been very lucky. All my investors are great.
If
you watch Shark Tank, they keep talking about how much they work with the companies that they invest in. My previous experience in entrepreneurship, generally investors will help, but their time is valuable. So generally they'll help in terms of like making an introduction for you or something along those lines. Mark gets super into it. And I don't think it's just the drug company. I think it's all his individual company. I have no idea how he has the time. He at least generally a couple times a week, he gets involved like operational stuff in the company at least once a week. We have a discussion and a back and forth about how things are going. And that, in my experience in the entrepreneurial world, tends to be the exception, not the rule. But he's very hands-on and very knowledgeable about the nitty-gritty details. It's really impressive.
The interest certainly helps that. How much is involved in setting up something? Was it like you had lawyers and they had lawyers and all this, or is that all kind of done in the Y Combinator? They make that easy, getting that union going.
There are sort of like sample templates now for accepting like early stage investments available. So I did start a company before in grad school. I started a company that makes door handles that dispense waterless hand sanitizer when you use them.
Oh, okay.
Yep. So the idea was to keep doctors and nurses from forgetting to wash their hands between paper rooms.
Yeah.
And at the time, I'm the same age as Mark Zuckerberg. Not exactly as successful.
To our wives, we are. And
yeah.
In our hearts, we are.
Darn skinny. Darn skinny.
We don't need to compare to anybody else.
But before he made it kind of popular for there to be like young entrepreneurs.
Yeah.
There was a time like, this is kind of like early to mid 2000s where, investors still wanted like gray haired, sort of older guys to like gray haired white men to like, steward the company once the early stage founders have done.
Yeah.
And there are a lot more, the sort of pathway to getting financing as a young entrepreneur wasn't as well, the template documents didn't really exist at the time. So then I remember my first company, we did a full series of, like for a small seed capital round, like did a full equity raise. There was like shares of stock issued. And that was kind of a nightmare of lawyers. We had lawyers on our side. We had other side had lawyer on their side. And, you know, the lawyers get paid by the hour. So it's in their interest to like make things as complicated as possible. And the deal fell almost fell apart, you know, several times. You know, it was just a nightmare. But that's kind of like a, almost of a bygone era, because now there are so many startups that sort of raise money is more, I don't want to say like standardized, but you know, they're just expectations now. So generally it's, you know, for most of my investors, you know, generally, you know, they heard me pitch. We have an email back and forth, have coffee for, you know, 30 minutes an hour. And generally afterwards they say yes or no. The documents are all sort of standard. Everyone knows what to expect.
That's great.
If someone's serious, they'll make a decision in about a day. And yeah, wire money in about a week is generally the expectation.
That was really enlightening because I had no idea. That was a great way to explain it. It's probably like everything's kind of standardized. There might be some talk about final percentages and things, but all like the customer stuff are standardized. Well, some of the handheld things have made that easier. Not that you maybe would do that deal on a handheld, but there's like funding, you know, programs and stuff that probably have almost made it into like an app, you know, like big deals into an app.
There are actually apps. I forget which one. I can't remember the one I used, but you know, if your listeners want to look up something called a SAFE agreement, SAFE, simple agreement for future equity.
Okay.
That's generally the one that's for seed stage investments. That's very commonly used. And just those document, those template forms. You know, obviously once you get past that, you know, the interim, you know, for larger equity financing, it gets more complicated and more individual. But yeah, well, in terms of like, if you're looking to start a startup, like those are generally the documents that you'll get your initial investments on.
I saw it too, Alex. You had your hands in a little bit of the COVID-19 with supplies and things like that. Are you doing something with that too?
Oh, sure. So, yeah, this is a kind of a long story, but, you know, essentially a contact reached out to me towards the start of the COVID-19 pandemic. This, you know, early March of last year, who was the CEO of a hospital system that I had been introduced to at one point. I was like, hey, Alex, your medical supply chain stuff, is there a way you can help us get N95 masks? And I was like, well, I'll check, and basically just put up, you know, Y Combinator for its alumni has just like a message board. And I posted someone have N95 masks. And yeah, I got connected to several people who had similar requests at the same time, including people who had worked extensively with, you know, China, sort of Chinese supply lines. Yeah, we all kind of came together. We started a nonprofit called Project N95, which then coalesced into an even larger group of people doing the same thing called the C19 Coalition, basically a whole bunch of well-meaning people who had the same idea at the same time. And yeah, I think we, you know, since the start of that, we're able to distribute Project N95 alone about 5 million
wow.
pieces of PPE, and the C19 Coalition more broadly, I think over a billion units of PPE
wow.
Over the last year. So, you know, I was one of the founding members of that, but sort of stepped away after a few months of crisis. Had ended, or not ended, it hasn't ended, it still hasn't.
The worst part of the PPE.
Yeah, the worst part of it. And so there was an infrastructure at that point, and what I had to offer was not particularly helpful anymore. So I sort of bowed out of it at that point, but it's still around. I actually just looked it up out of curiosity the other day. It's, you know, there's a whole board of directors, hundreds of volunteers. I said, oh, yeah, and still have PPE available. You know, to aggregate and ship through that website. So
it's amazing how fast some of that stuff happened, you know, because for a while in the pharmacy, and all the listeners know this, there was a few weeks where, you know, everything was out and stuff. But then it's like, it's amazing how fast capitalism gets stuff going for people to make a rightful dollar on some of that stuff. This is kind of a cliche question, but let's say 10 years from now, do you see yourself being, you know, very involved with this company? Do you see yourself saying, okay, I'm going to go do something else because my skills lie in doing these other ideas? What do you think you would be doing in 10 years?
Oh, I actually really don't think about that. Not just saying that, really don't. I it's hard. The companies are so encompassing. I can't really envision doing anything else but that. But 10 years is so far out, who knows? But yeah, my only foreseeable plan is to keep running the company and growing it, because there's plenty of stuff to do for 10 years.
If you're an 18-year-old again, back how many years ago, we won't say, how old are you?
So I'm 36.
All right, so 18. So that was half of your life. So if you were 18 again, any huge diversions that you would have avoided? Would you have done things about like you did now? Would you have taken a different path? Or would things have been about the same for you?
I think I probably, my definite regret is I did not learn to code better when I had more time to do it. No, I can't code. My PhD required coding, obviously.
Gotcha.
But that's, very sub-specialized mathematical coding.
Right.
Design or anything like that.
Something to make like the swamp AI.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and that's,
important stuff like that.
It's not super useful for making like a marketplace app. I think that's an incredibly valuable skill set. I know it's cliche, like you're saying, it's cliche to say, but it's super true. It's such a valuable skill set. I probably would have built that up more. There's still plenty of time to do it, but it's just easier when you're young and have lots of time on your hands. But I probably would have ventured out into entrepreneurship perhaps a little bit earlier. Really kind of clicked for me. Just takes a long time to get properly trained as a medical doctor and a pharmacist. And there's a reason for all that time. Just know what you're doing and not kill people. You gotta spend a lot of time learning it.
Is there a chance that you would have, there's always a chance, but would you might have not got a medical degree and maybe been more in computers? Or are you thinking more just hobby-wise that you would have taken the time when you could computer-wise?
Yeah, probably more hobby-wise. View it as a great privilege to help it.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it's hard. And it's so part of my personality, my definition of self at this point, that hard to envision anything else. Certainly would have been good to have the other skills that would be helpful at this point. Yeah.
When you say programming, is that kind of like a skill, like learning how to do woodworking and the tools are not that important? You could use different saws and different companies, electronic, hammers or whatever, different tools, but you still know the process? Or is it tied down more into one coding? Because I'm always thinking like, if I learned it, I'd probably learn the wrong one. Is that not a thing to worry about?
I think there's probably a middle ground in there. It's
middle,
going between two different types of saws is probably easier than
two different
programming languages. But there's still a lot of overlap. Like JavaScript or Python, I think, your ability to understand like C++, there's a lot.
You're going to learn it a lot quicker. And
yeah, exactly. I think it's more like learning different languages, like not programming, just like verbal.
No, right. You'll learn those more easily.
Yeah. And especially, if there's similar language and there's probably more overlap there.
Like German and English are fairly similar versus Chinese or something like that.
A lot of it is there's a lot of math and algorithms that go into it. And those are the programming languages.
Gotcha.
I think it's probably somewhere in between.
In between the two of those.
Between learning a different language each time, like verbal language each time, using a different set of tools each time. That's not completely transferable, but at the same time, it's not like like learning Mandarin each time you got to learn to a new programming language.
Right. What advice do you wish you maybe would have been given let's say at 18? What advice do you wish you could have been given? Let's say that maybe you knew intrinsically that you could have done more programming. It was something that you could have maybe thought of on your own then. Any advice that you wish you would have gotten back when you got your first degree that externally maybe could have helped you?
Probably take more risks.
More risks.
More risks in general. It's always scary to venture out from what you're doing. But I think if you look at the data as much as you can, people who tend to take more risks with their career seem to wind up doing better. Control risk, you don't want to do like crazy stuff, but if you don't take some element of risk in your life, even in just your professional life, you know, you'll never really get the reward from it. So
I always say that, like, where you look at these Inc. articles, you know, INC, you look at those articles and everybody had gone through like three or four catastrophes, not down to the bottom, but I mean, they've all been through their struggles. And I tell my wife, it's like, this is maybe 10 years ago. It's like, well, I can't worry so much about things because nobody starts usually down here and just has this straight trajectory going up. And it's like, I don't know why I try to fight for that so much and get so much anxiety that that doesn't happen, because that's nobody's story. Everybody's story has the ups and downs. So that's really good advice.
Absolutely. Yeah, no. And you only have to succeed once, you know?
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, like you didn't fail like a dozen times, but if you just hit it right once, then...
So one time. Yeah, I'm still waiting for mine. Yeah, that's right. Hey, Alex, what a pleasure talking to you. Best wishes.
Hey, no, wait back at you. I really appreciate you taking the time to chat today. It's always fun to do these kind of things. And yeah, if any of your listeners want to chat about the business, I'm Alex at CostPlusDrugs.com.
Wonderful. We'll be watching. Well, thanks a lot, Alex, and continued best wishes on everything you're doing.
Thanks a lot. Really appreciate it.
All right. Talk to you again. Thank you.
Bye.
You've been listening to the Business of Pharmacy podcast with me, your host, Mike Kelzer. Please subscribe for all future episodes.